2 with Dr. Alan Whitaker, March 7, 1997. Now, you were saying that your parents decided to leave Middlesex.
And go to Zeblin. Dr. Armie Strickland, A-R-M-I-E Strickland, had moved to St. Petersburg, Florida. He became quite a prominent society doctor in St. Petersburg, Florida. And that left a vacancy in Zeblin. And my stepfather moved to Zeblin. And
including your family?
Well, yeah. One daughter and my mother and me and stepfather, four of us.
And you were how old?
11. And Zeblin was, it was almost like going to college. Going from Nash County to Zeblin was quite in Wake County was quite a step up. The school was entirely it was definitely much more sophisticated. And I was afraid to go to school, and a cousin of mine who had gone there, it was a boarding school too, kind of Red Oak. And she had gone there and she knew the teachers and people, and she was a delightful person, and she went with me to school the first day because I was too timid. But to my surprise, I was well received. It was a novelty to have a doctor's son in the neighborhood because they hadn't had that experience probably ever. Yes, they had. There was a doctor over at Wakefield, which is 2 miles away, that had several sons. They were very prominent people in Raleigh. And but anyway, I was a novelty in Zeblin, and they were very kind to me. In high school, I was elected to every office they had. I didn't run for any, they just elected me to every office. Zeblin was nice to me. They're cold now, but they were nice to me when I was living there.
Okay, how did you wind up in Rocky Mount?
Well, I'm glad you asked. My father was from Gold Rock. He owned some farms. I inherited them. And until 1931, I had plenty of money. I had plenty of money at Chapel Hill. I had four new cars. And I got along good. In 1931, the farm rent went to nothing. And I had to borrow some money. And Mr. Buck Boddy, who was registered deeds in Nash County, and a friend of my family, loaned me a little over $3,000, which was well secured because I had the good security, but nobody had any cash. I dare say almost no one had any cash, except Mr. Buck Boddy. I tried all the other lending agencies. So I knew that he wanted his money back. It was a short-term loan, even though we didn't discuss it. And I knew he was getting old and he wanted his money. And to establish a practice, my friend said, you got to work 2 years before you make your bread and butter. And Dr. Wall had a big practice in Rocky Mount. He said it was 2 years before he made his living. Well, that was typical throughout the state. It's entirely different from the present situation. So I had to have some money coming in for sure, and so Dr. Roy Norton was health officer of Rocky Mount. He later became superintendent of the state health department. And he told me about how they needed some health officers and how it paid you every month. So I got to go to the public health school at Chapel Hill for a short course. It was just before they opened up the real public health school. This was a abbreviated public health school before Dr. Rosenau came down and opened up the big school of public health. In other words, I was not after a degree, I was just after a short course to learn the fundamentals. And there's four or five of us in the class. One, Dr. Sumner from Asheville, already had his job waiting for him, and a doctor from Philadelphia was going back to Pennsylvania. So the three of us, after one job at Mount Airy, and I got it. And I went to Mount Airy, and that was a lovely town. Gosh, you've ever been there?
I've been through there.
Well, it's a beautiful town, and it's well diversified. They've got quite a diversification of industry. They've got textiles, furniture, like five furniture factories. They've got big peach orchards, big tobacco market, big apple orchards, mirror factories. I can't begin to, well, anyway, it was a lovely community. I went down and stayed 6 months, and this thing opened up down here, and somebody called and told me it opened up. And this was close to my roots and my farms. And so I couldn't turn it down, even though I was happy up there. And they said, well, how much will it cost to keep you in Mount Airy? I said, Mr. Folger, it's not money, I just want to go back home. He said, well, sometimes going back home is a mistake. He was B. Frank Folger. He ran the county. He was the boss of the county. The Folgers were state politicians of the first magnitude, congressmen and whatever. And so I came back down here and got on the payroll for the city. And as another chapter of my life, which is very interesting, and I've written a lot down, but I saw the depression. I saw the dirty part of the depression.
Tell me about it.
Well, as you know, the cities suffered more than the country people during the depression. And I had a wonderful staff, there's probably no political area of this size in the world that had as much public health as Rocky Mount. We had five nurses. We had four sanitarians. Hell, they don't have that many in the National Educational put together probably now, I don't reckon. We had a laboratory. We handled the milk inspection for this area. And public health was much more important in the era before refrigeration and freezing food than it has been since. People had utmost respect for public health after the public health movement established itself. That is, in the 20s and 30s. And this was a marvelous health department, and you know, health officers go to a lot of symposia and things, all for the benefit of the children of the future. You know, been to a thousand of those, to make a better world for our children and grandchildren. Well, at those meetings, I'd meet people from other cities, and they all said that how lucky I was to go to Rocky Mountain. Says that's probably one of the nicest governed cities in North Carolina. And so I came here because of its proximity to my farm and roots. And I grew to like it. Of course, I knew a lot of people already.
My mama used to talk about an epidemic of undulant fever. Does that ring a bell with you?
Well, of course, undulant fever was not the most frightening thing.
That was why they got rid of their cow.
And yeah.
Did you ever do any inspections on the Griffin Dairies out in Benvenue?
Yeah, Randolph. Yeah, I said I didn't inspect theirs, but I had men who did.
And Tez?
Tez too, yeah.
And Lynn had one that until the Second World War. You weren't here then.
Well, were you here then? I was here through the World War, yeah. They didn't let me stay here. In fact, I was in the U.S. Public Health Service Reserves, and they signed me to Rock Mountain, which is, I was already here.
But, see, my family worried about milk because...
Because a lot of people died from the dairies.
Well, and my daddy and my uncles had all those dairies, and they...
Was Tad Griffin your uncle?
Yes. And what they did was they didn't sterilize the milk. They ran it over cold pipes. I've forgotten what they... call that. We go up in this upstairs room and pour the milk down and run over these refrigerated pipes.
Yeah.
And they bottled it with a machine that had these bottles that went around in circles and put these little caps in them.
Yeah. Well, you see, back in the 20s and 30s, you had Griffin's Dairy, Buck Overton's Dairy.
I live in Old Man Buck's cow pasture right now.
Where you live out there?
Goose Creek.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember standing back there about where that hospital is talking to Mr. Buck Overton one time. That was Jones' property from Red Oak, do you know it?
Well, I think Ms. Overton was sisters with
Mrs.
Jones Bass.
Yeah. I think that Jones lives right there in the corner.
Yeah.
Those county commissioners good friends of mine before I came to Rock Mountain.
You gonna talk about Frederick Cooper?
Well, Frederick was he was kind of old man Alf Cooper up back at Hillston, you know. And his son ran this dairy out here where Marita Bread is, Tom Cooper. He had a dairy out there. And the Cuppers were very close friends to the Whitakers because my uncle, Henry Whitaker, lived in the Seven Doctor House at Hedgeston. He was a country doctor up there. And he rode those red clay hills around there in a horse and buggy.
Do you know old man Jake Taylor?
Well, I know, you're talking about the one over in half, over the other side of Go Rock?
I'm talking about the one that Taylor's gin.
Oh, yeah. His daughter was a good friend of mine. Gertrude Wheeler's was Taylor. Gertrude Taylor Wheeler's. She worked for me for about 40 years. She died last year. It was a sad thing. But she came from Taylor's gin. I know all those people, and the ones I don't know, I've heard a thousand tales about them. And I knew Grace Taylor before she married. She was a Collins. And those Collins were connected up at Wakefield, which is close to Zeblin, and they used to come up there in the summer. I knew all those Collins girls before I moved in down here. But I've heard all this know about the Taylors.
Let me ask you. When you came to Rocky Mount, what were the major health considerations?
Well, diphtheria, polio, typhoid fever, malaria.
Malaria?
I won't tell you about that later. Syphilis. Gonorrhea, chancroid, and the other venereal diseases.
you didn't have penicillin. How'd you treat them?
It wasn't easy. It was hard. I happened to be well, when I told you I had this opportunity to go to Mount Airy, and then I was told that there's an opening down here, and 6 months later I came and interviewed for this job and got this job. And when I went to my first Board of Health meeting, I expected a lot of intelligent people, but I'd been told that Rocky Mount was an exceptional town as far as government was concerned, that it had a history of good government. They could sell their bonds cheaper than other towns. During the Depression, they went through with sales flying. Some cities went bankrupt. Asheville went bankrupt. Most of them were hard up, like Raleigh. But Nash County and Rocky Mount went through with flying colors. I went to the Board of Health meeting and I found out that they were on the ball. And they knew that Rocky Mount had a horrible venereal disease problem. And the doctors weren't paying it any mind. And they didn't issue any orders, but they did let me know they were interested in that problem. They had, their interest may have been exaggerated some by the fact that they thought it was communicable to the house, in the household, which it wasn't. There's a lot of domestic servants. They weren't about to catch the venereal diseases that way, but they didn't know that. And I used it to my advantage in my program to of that, and they allowed me to establish clinics. I don't know whether we were the first or the second, but we...
Did you work with Dr. Large?
Well, yeah, but that was different. Dr. Large was the man who, if I wanted to go off, which I didn't often, my idea of a vacation was 3 days off, but he would cover for me. And, he was at Parkview at that time, and he'd been health officer here right after World War I. I think he was the second health officer. The first health officer in Rocky Mount was Dr. J.A. Braswell from Whitaker's. He came here, I think, right after Nash County put in a health department. Nash County was one of the first group of counties that put in health departments. It wasn't the first, but it was in the first 10. It's one of the first 10 counties.
What did Rocky Mount pay you as a physician for?
The most they ever paid me was $5,000.
You don't remember what your starting salary was?
It was about $3,000. That was very little. But that was a lot.
Could you also practice privately, or was that?
No, that was against the rule. They had previously allowed Dr. Large to do that, and they cut that out. You could not do it. Dr. Coppridge got in trouble over in Nashville. He was a health officer, and somebody got in a wreck and they needed a dose of morphine, and he refused to give it to him. Health officers weren't supposed to practice because he, and so they got a big stink over that. The thing divided up with sides, Medical Society and State Board of Health with each other's throat over that. The State Board of Health said that Dr. Coppedge was wrong, and the Iowa Medical Society said he was right. And I wrote the letters for our side to put in the paper. I didn't get into it personally, but I'd write the letters. And we won. Outside won.
Outside won.
But anyway, Dr. copies were not supposed to practice medicine if he's health officer. But they weren't all that tight on it, but you didn't practice medicine and get a fee. You didn't practice medicine for your benefit, for the doctor's benefit.
But how long did you stay the public health officer?
Ten years.
And then you went into private practice?
No, then I went to New York and I had a chance of a nice residency up there at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. And it was just too good to turn down. I had a choice between that and to continue public health with a scholarship to Harvard or Johns Hopkins. I could take my choice. All expenses. And I decided to get out of public health.
And I had married at this time?
Yeah, I wasn't married when I came here, but I was married when I got out. And so my wife's father helped us, and I had a farm. But that was a help. And anyway, we tested out, and I went off in public health. Our first check was $22 half a month. But I did get my food and a nice place to stay and uniforms and stuff like that. And I was in a lovely place. I had some nice patients, Madam Chiang Kai-shek, Ms. Roosevelt.
Oh, wow.
Finance Minister of China, Mr. Chin, presidents of many, many corporations.
Was Madam Chiang very beautiful?
Not to me, she was in bed. Catherine Cornell. She was a patient too. You know who she was?
She was a movie actress, wasn't
she? No, she was a stage actress.
Stage actress.
The top. And a lot of others. It was very interesting residency. And people said, why did you go into urology? Well, it was a misunderstanding. I didn't know how hard it was.
I didn't know that you went into urology.
I was a urologist. I was the first urological surgeon to come to this part of the country, east of Raleigh.
I want to turn this off and ask you a question.
Well, let me finish this one sentence. There was a urologist in Fayetteville, but I'm not sure Fayetteville and Wilmington are east of Rocky Mount. But anyway, from here east, I was the only urologist at first, when I first came here. There was not one in New Bern or any of those towns. You turn it off?
Yeah. Because today is March the 12th, and we're continuing the interview with Dr. Whitaker, who is going to tell us about public health conditions in Rocky Mount during his early days here.
Nash County. Well, I'm going back much further than my days in Rocky Mount. I'm going back to 1910 when I lived in Middlesex. And before I started school, public school, there was no sanitation. The usual town had a pump or well, and there was a bucket and a dipper for white people and a bucket and a dipper for colored people.
Not even a pitcher pump.
Some places had pumps, pretty nice pumps, but it was still pumps of wells. And the schoolhouse had a wood pile in the yard and a heater. There were two or three room schools for the most part. And they were heated by woods which the students brought in from the wood pile. The water was a bucket of water sitting on the table in the corner was a dipper for the students. The privy in 1910 was not even a pit privy. The first pit privies were introduced about, let's see, 1913. And they were only introduced into public schools in Nash County. It consisted of a pit on top of which was a concrete frame, a circular thing with seats, with holes, maybe a dozen holes around this circular concrete slab. And that sat over a hole in the ground. And of course that was enclosed. And that was a big improvement over the previous privy, which had no, it was just the ground.
Must have smelled awful even when they had a pit.
Well, it was far enough from the school building that you didn't smell it. And of course, the dogs and the chickens were into the excrement all the time, scratching around, you know. Then they were tracking it all over the community. And consequently, the children had hookworms. The way they got hookworms was in summer they went barefooted. And the ova of the worms, I mean the larva of the worms, would be in the mud and sand that they played in. And they would have what they call ground itch, which was itching between the toes. That's why the larva of the hookworms entered the lymph channels. And through the lymph channels, they worked their way up into the heart and then into the lungs. Then they would cough and cough it into the esophagus and swallow it. It would go into the stomach. Then another phase of this parasite would develop and become a worm. And the hookworm had a ability to bite, had tooth-like hooks stuck into the side of the intestine. And he stayed there and ate and thrived and grew. And of course he sapped the strength of the child or the adult. And there were a lot of very scrawny looking, pale children who didn't grow. They ate, but they didn't grow. And it was a concern of anemic. And of course, some of the adults were too. And everybody was aware of that. And then about 1912, the Rockefeller Foundation, Rockefeller had the word sanitation in this foundation. They financed the project, which was conducted by the State Board of Health, the United States Public Health Service, and the local physicians. There was no health department. And they would go into, we'll start with Nash County, they would go into a place like Rocky Mountain, establish two or three stations. They'd go to Red Oak and put one station, and they'd go to Spring Oak and put in one, Nashville, Middlesex, Bailey. And I saw the one in Zeblin. It was a vacant house, which had recently been vacated. It was in good condition, and they used the empty rooms for laboratories. The laboratory consisted of a microscope and a pitcher of water, and they had no running water. And they passed out little pill boxes about 2 inches in diameter, which were given to the general population. And of course, there was a lot of publicity went along with this.
Okay. So in their laboratory, were they testing for...
They're testing for ova. They're testing feces for ova.
Okay, of the people who came in.
Yeah, everybody in the county. They were trying to get everybody to come in. And of course, they cooperated very well. Long lines of mules and wagons and horses and buggies and all those things, no automobiles.
And the pill would cure it?
It wasn't in the pill, it was a pill box. There weren't the pills.
Oh.
I mean, I haven't got to any pills yet. We're just talking about the pill box.
Dr. Whitaker is talking about the public health project financed by the Rockefeller Foundation to attack hookworm in the population, and about the laboratories that were set up and how they did their work.
The pill boxes were given to the general population. The feces collected and brought in the pill box to this makeshift laboratory. And they would take it and put it under the microscope, and if they saw ova, they knew the child was wormy. He had worms. And a lot of people already knew it, but they'd seen some worms in the excrement and the stools. But most of them didn't know it. And so if they had worms, they'd give them thymol pills, T-H-Y-M-O-L. It was a medicine which they took, and it would kill the worms. And as soon as the worm died, he would turn loose the side of the intestine. And then the worm would come out when the bowels moved. And that was a sight, because there'd be a whole lot of worms, probably two hands full of worms. And that was shocking to the parents and to the child. I mean, it was awful. So then they'd go back to the clinic, and they'd give them these thymol tablets. No, I've already given them the thymol tablets, and that got rid of the worms. And then the child would begin to get rosy cheeks, grow, eat, and thrive. And it was like the miracles in the Bible. And the people could see it. It was the most vivid, miraculous thing that anybody had ever seen. And it was all over the state, every county. Nash was running in the forefront. And it made people believe in public health and sanitation. But making them believe in it and comply with the rules of sanitation were two different things. So they had signs and flyers and everything. So if you spit on the floor at home, you may spit on the floor here, and things like that, you know. I tell you not to spit on the floor. And of course, we didn't spit on the floor at my house but once. these fellows from the the United States Public Health Service and the Rockefeller Foundation were very smart. People in this area would recognize Dr. Farrell, whose sister was taught Latin in the Rocky Mountain High Schools back as late as World War II. He was one of the original people who cleaned up North Carolina. Dr. Jaycox from Tarboro was another. And they use this as a selling point to sell the county commissioners and the legislature to appropriate money for public health. They'd had this vivid picture. And North Carolina developed the best program in the country. It was became a model for other states. And it was copied throughout the South. The North had the same problem in a different way. They didn't go barefooted as much in the North as we did. Here it was customary May 1st every year to pull off your shoes.
My mama said May the 10th.
Well, it varied. And that's, everybody went barefooted by choice. In the North, it probably was different. But, and also the worms probably didn't flourish in the cold ground. It may have been, but they had worm problems too. That problem was tapeworms. Some tapeworms were 30 feet long, and you can imagine the consternation of a family that child would do a worm 30 feet long. And they were miracles again. We had some tapeworms, but I can't recall it, but I know we had them. So that stimulated an interest in public health, and the leaders jumped on the opportunity and tried to get health departments formed, and they did. And most counties in the state got a health department. Nash was one of the first, it was in the first group of 10, one of the first ones to get a health department in 1916. Dr. Amble Speight.
Spell that name.
S-P-E-I-G-H-T.
No, the first.
A-M-B-L-E-R.
Ambler, okay.
He was the first health officer in Nash County and one of the first in the state. And the next public health project was about 1912 or 13. The Colgate Company bought little tubes of, about 1 ounce tubes of toothpaste and a small toothbrush and gave one to every child in the public schools of Nash County and taught them about oral hygiene. And that was the first time most everybody had seen a toothbrush. Of course, I'd seen them before that. Prior to toothbrushes, they used dogwood limbs, little sprout on a dogwood tree or a gum tree. And it was a hard sell, public health. And Rocky Mount, thymol was a toxic drug. It rarely killed anybody, but it did kill one person. And I don't think it was a Rocky Mount citizen, but Rocky Mount found out about it and then refused to participate any further in the project for quite a while, and finally got over it. And every little crossroads town and in Nash County, there was some group of people that had some common sense and a little bit above the average. And they were the ones that fostered the public health movement. And after they got the health department, of course, it picked up speed. And the big problem was vaccinating for smallpox, typhoid fever, and then introducing a sanitation program. They had two big problems. One was typhoid fever, which was a filth-borne disease. When a person got typhoid fever, that meant he'd gotten hold of some bacteria that came from some other person. It was often spoken of as a short circuit between somebody's anus and somebody else's mouth. I mean, to be crude, that's what it was. And that could be just an invisible stain on your hand that you couldn't see or smell to gross dirtiness,
yeah.
Filth. We had no refrigeration, of course, and that was a problem. And they were just getting pit privies, so you can see the problem with the feces on every lot.
So you're really saying that the first big attack had nothing to do with miracle drugs or miracle surgery, or it was just cleaning the place up?
Yeah. And that hookworm was the ideal way to do it. That convinced anybody, white, black, colored, I mean.
How did the physician keep from having folks cough this stuff in their faces and having it too?
Well, I don't know of any. I know my stepfather used the hand wash with bichloride of mercury, and he got allergic to the mercury and had to stop using it. That was a very good disinfectant. And rubber gloves were kind of crude, thick rubber, they weren't very practical. And remember, it just wasn't but about 20 years, 30 years before that they found anything, learned about the germ theory. They didn't even know about bacteria until Lister.
And what was the date on that?
It was after the Civil War. I say about 1870s, and so that they knew nothing about sterile precautions. And, well, they did in 1912, of course. Mm-hmm. Those doctors did, but the older doctors didn't believe it even then. And so after they got the health department, they got the sanitarian, they got the public health nurse and the health officer, the problem then was to get some laws in the books. And they didn't get a hell of a lot of cooperation on that. A lot of people just didn't believe in that new fol-de-rol. But gradually through those few people with common sense in Spring Hope, Middlesex, Nashville, Zeblin, Rocky Mount, they were able to get the laws on the books. Then the problem was to enforce the laws. And we owe a lot of credit to the original sanitarians. I think Pete Neal in Rocky Mount was one of the very first in the state. They had the hard work. It was dangerous too. And the nurses had an equally hard job, because people just didn't believe in sanitation. If they had the cows, and you'd tell them the cow had, you'd test the cow, and you'd tell them the cow had tuberculosis, and that's why the mother was sick in bed, dying of tuberculosis, caught it from the cow, they didn't believe it. Well, you had to kill the cow. And then they began to test the cows for tuberculosis. North Carolina was the first state in the Union to clear up all tubercular cows. We were the first state to have no tuberculosis in the cows. Well, see, dairymen, they didn't love that, because you go out there and say, this cow's got tuberculosis, that might have been his best milk cow. And that she's going to get sick pretty soon, but maybe at that time she wasn't sick. And the fellow had a time convincing people that they had to get rid of the cow. And also,
you're talking about, I've heard of tuberculosis of the bone, and I think that Thomas Wolfe died of tuberculosis of the brain, didn't he? So when you get a cow, but mainly I think of tuberculosis as
lung. But you can have it anywhere.
All right, and so what you got from the cow could be from, you could get it anywhere.
Yeah. That was when bovine tuberculosis was spread to people. And
from the milk.
Yeah. From the milk. And the difference in the county and the city, out in the county, a farmer would have a cow, maybe two cows. And he and maybe his next door neighbor would be the only ones that would drink that milk. His family and maybe a neighbor. Whereas in the city, might be 100 families drinking milk from Mr. Overton's dairy. Or
from Mr. my daddy's dairy.
Yeah, in the dairies, Griffin, Meadowbrook, Southern Dairies, all of those could spread it. So the health department, the sanitariums, and of course we had milk inspector in Rocky Mountain because we took care of the whole surrounding area, as well as Tarboro and Nash County, as well as Rocky Mountain. And they began to pasteurize milk. That would sterilize it. And you could heat it to about 100 degrees. You didn't have to boil it. Heat it almost to a boil, and that pasteurized it. And most people couldn't tell the difference in the taste, but some could. The city attorney here never believed in pasteurized milk. He wouldn't drink pasteurized milk.
I hated it. Yeah. I can remember being 5 years old and moving to Baltimore and beginning, having my first pasteurized milk in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And I knew the difference.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you a question, and I lost it.
But the nurses, and especially the sanitariums, had a hard job selling that new way of doing things. Sanitary, you know, hard to sell them on that. And very hard.
Did you ever deal with issues of nutrition?
I did, but I happened to be a hobby of mine. I was up at Duke in about 1936-7. And in the office overlooking the quadrangle was Dr. Milam, who was the United States Public Health Service.
M-I-L-L-A-M?
One L. He was heading a project, I think that too was financed by the Rockefeller Foundation and the State Board of Health. He would conduct a nutrition project. And what they would do is they'd go into a place like Alamance County, or say Nash County, but I remember Alamance is an example he told me about. He said, we'd go in there with our staff and nurses and some men, and we'd go to the Ruritan Club, we'd go to the churches, we'd go to all the where people assemble, and we'd tell them what we're trying to do. All we're going to do is ask questions and tabulate what they're eating. We're not going to give them anything. We're not going to take away anything. We just want to know what they're eating. And we're going to call on them at mealtime. And we want them to understand that. So they got permission from these organizations and the general public, churches and things. And they'd pop in at breakfast, at lunch, supper, and see actually what they were really eating. And they found out that the people in North Carolina were deficit in calcium and vitamin C particularly. They were the two things I remember that we were deficient in. And of course, if you're deficient in calcium, you get osteoporosis and the teeth would decay more, and if you didn't get vitamin C, what did I say the other one was?
Vitamin C and calcium.
For vitamin C, you get scurvy and signs of scurvy, and almost all the school children had it. I'd go into school in Rocky Mound in September or October, take a little tongue depressor and rub it across the gums, and they'd blanch like they were supposed to do. You go back in the spring, about March or April, and rub it across there, and I guess, and the beads of blood would pop up. They had gingivitis from lack of vitamin C. They just were not getting vitamin C. And
is there any way that public health could improve that?
Through education. It was available to everybody.
In what form here?
Well, you could, most people could buy orange and lemon once in a while, or a green vegetable, collards. I suppose a lot of ways they could get, but see, a lot of children don't love collards.
No, you gotta have some years on you before you can appreciate collards.
Yeah, I was an old man before I did. But anyway, they were very healthy, and there's a lot of ways they could get vitamin C. And gradually, the sanitation improved, and Rocky Mount, I came to Rocky Mount October 1st, 1935, and I was amazed at how far advanced Rocky Mount was. If a person needed to go to the hospital, money was no factor. They could go to the hospital. The procedure, if you didn't have any money, was to go to the welfare worker, and they would send you to the health department. And if they recommended that to go with assisted hospitalization, the health officer would okay it. I depended on them to say whether this person needed help. And it was no problem, hardly any delay in getting them in the hospital. Either they had the choice, Rocky Mount Sanatorium or Park View. And that was for white and colored. No problem whatsoever in getting them in the hospital. Another thing that Kiwanis Club had the Christmas seals, and they made enough money from the sale of Christmas seals to afford x-rays for anybody. And any doctor who wanted an x-ray on a poor patient could get it without any question right away. And the Kiwanis Club would pay for it. That, you can't believe what a great godsend that was, because most counties had nothing of the sort. We had a lot of things that other counties didn't have.
A woman told me that she worked at the mill, and she was less than 20 years old, and they x-rayed everybody's chest at the mill, and they called her in and said that she had a spot on her lung. And then she told quite a story about being taken by Mr. Hammond Battle's secretary to Wilson, to some sanitarium there for further testing, and the things which were done, the way in which the mill supported her through the experience. And that was an interesting story.
Well, that was later on, after World War II, because she went to Wilson, to the sanitarium.
Yeah.
That wasn't there back in the 30s. We would test school children for tuberculosis, give them the, we would call it a
mantid. The time test.
Huh?
Is it called a time test?
We had another name, mantu or something, I forget what we called it. You just put the interdermal, end of skin, intradermal, make a little blister sort of.
Yeah.
If it turned red, of course, the older children in the senior class, most of them would turn red, whereas the younger ones wouldn't, because everybody was getting exposed to tuberculosis. I don't mean they were having it. But in 1910, it was the biggest killer in the area, probably in the state. It was the biggest killer in the state, tuberculosis. And it could come in so many manifestations. Like you mentioned a minute ago, you could have it almost anywhere in the body, eyes or lungs. And I learned that the hard way. I was an intern in Philadelphia, and this young colored woman in her 20s came in with a high fever of 105 or 6, real sick. And we hadn't made a diagnosis. In 24 hours, she was dead. And in those days, you try to get an autopsy. And the hospital was judged by how your percentage was on getting autopsies. It's not that way now. And wanted to find out. And so they told me to get an autopsy on this girl. So
how you doing today?
Fine.
That's good. Yes, ma'am.
I went down to Germantown where she lived in a section of town, and they didn't want to give an autopsy. I talked as pretty as I could to them and everything, and because I really wanted it. We didn't know why she died, but acute infection. In 2 or 3 days, she was dead. And I found out that they had this insurance where they go house to house, collect, and it has a clause in that if you have venereal disease, which all of them did, or tuberculosis, the rest of them did, the insurance wouldn't pay. And so.
And this was a burial insurance.
Well, it was insurance, several hundred dollars. I don't know what. You could use it for that, I guess. So I found out that was what was holding up the permission. And so they wanted to know why she died too. But they didn't want to relinquish the insurance. So I knew that anybody that died in 3 days with a high fever didn't have tuberculosis. At least that didn't kill them. So I guaranteed them that it wouldn't be tuberculosis. And I gave him my word and everything he could give to get that autopsy. And so I got it. And I helped on the autopsy. And we went through this woman, she had tuberculosis everywhere in her brain, all over. It was what they call galloping consumption, fulminating, fast going.
I want to know what you put on the death certificate.
Well, that was a dilemma. I asked the pathologist. He was the nephew of a famous preacher, S. Parks Cadman. He used to preach on the radio. And he said, well, don't let your conscience get involved in this case because there's no place for your conscience. Says you're dealing with a bunch of crooks, those insurance people that write that kind of insurance. They're all a bunch of crooks. Says they know that these people have venereal disease, tuberculosis, or some other dormant thing that's excluded, but says that the patients don't know it, and the patient's family don't know it. And so you don't have any moral obligation there. But I'd given them my word. So I couldn't get out of that thing to my satisfaction. And I studied, till the next day, to get the death certificate out. So what I did, one of the secretaries, there was a friend of mine, a lady, I said, what do you think of me filling out this death certificate yesterday, dating it yesterday? That's what I should have done in the first place, but I held it up till we could get the autopsy. So I went back and dated the thing before the autopsy, and put what we thought it was at that time. Well, that satisfied me, satisfied the Lord, And the insurance company didn't know anything about it. And the colored people got the money.
Are we still going? Yes, I don't. That was a really good story. I would have been unhappy if we didn't have that on tape, but we do have it. What else did you see? You saw tuberculosis and hookworm. What was the cause of most maternal deaths?
Most maternal deaths were preventable. It was poor nutrition, poor general care, no check on the blood pressure or the urine, or none of those things. They had no prenatal care. And the causes of death were multiple. Tuberculosis was a big one. And that was a big cause of death. And we established the Well Baby Clinic, and then the maternity clinic, and that reduced the death rate tremendously after we got the Junior Gill into it. The Junior Gill saw they got to the doctor, they saw that they got the medicine, they saw they had the right food for the mothers and the babies. It just made a difference. They got them a ride to the clinic and went shopping for them. You can't believe what they did for them. It's amazing. And it reduced the death rate 100% the first year. I don't remember the figures. And I think it came from, 17% down to less than 10% the first year. Oh, and 1940, they had to register for the draft. And you can't believe how much respect and authority the health officer had in those days. And I just declared an edict. All males who register for the draft have to have a blood test for syphilis. Nobody, not one, questioned it. Every male in Rocky Mount under the draft age, 55, from 18 to 55, had a blood test.
What did you treat syphilis with in 1940?
Well, let's get through with this.
Okay.
25%